Open.
Outspoken.
It's Ophthalmology Off the Grid.
An honest look at controversial topics in the field. I'm Blake Williamson.
I'm Gary Wirtz.
Hello, and thank you for listening to Ophthalmology Off the Grid. In this episode, Dr. Eric Donenfeld joins Drs. Gary Wirtz and Blake Williamson to discuss how he grew from a small private practice by constantly adapting to a dynamic industry. Support for this podcast comes from Bryn Mawr Communications. BMC produces a number of informative podcast series spanning a variety of topics in ophthalmology. Discover a new show at itube.net/podcasts.
Welcome to another episode of Ophthalmology Off the Grid. I'm here with my main man, Gary Wirtz, and we have another episode for this season of Building Your Business and Building Your Brand. And I'm surprised it's taken us a minute to get Dr. Donenfeld on. He's a very busy man. He's got a lot of things going on. He does a lot of podcasts, but we finally got him. And I don't know if there's anybody better to talk to in terms of someone who's seen it all, been through it all, many different practice styles, has participated in building a practice, has participated in private equity, you name it. So he really is going to have a lot to teach us, not only from building your own business, but also working with industry and sort of growing that side, of what you do on the consulting side. So, Gary, I think we're going to end for a great episode.
No, absolutely. This whole season has been Clash of the Titans, and I think each week it just like keeps getting more exciting for us. I'm so excited to talk to Eric. Eric, I'm going to let you introduce yourself, and then I'm going to tell a little story that I think will encapsulate some of the ways you've helped me in my career. But yeah, Eric, thanks so much for coming on. Give for maybe some younger ophthalmologists who haven't been in this game for more than a minute, just introduce yourself, talk about just a little brief synopsis of your practice, and we'll go from there.
Well, thanks. First of all, I can't imagine two people I'd rather be interviewed with than the two of you. You're both amazing people, and Gary, Blake, my hat's off to you. You do things differently, you do things uniquely, and I really admire the way you present yourself. So if I could say one thing, I'd say to my audience, be like Blake and Gary. That's what I would be like if I was building my brand. But my brand basically started when I finished my fellowship in cornea at Wills, and I went into practice. And I started out combining academics and clinical ophthalmology. I was a resident instructor. I became program director at Manhattan Eye and Ear. I joined a practice, and I've been in that same practice now for 35 years. And when I joined the practice, I was the third person in. We now have 180 ophthalmologists in our practice. I've been very involved in a lot of new technologies. I think that that's one of the exciting things about ophthalmology is we get to get involved in new things. I was initial investigator of LASIK, PRK, femtosecond laser, multifocal IOLs, femtosecond laser cataract surgery, a whole variety of pharmaceuticals as well. And, every day for me, being an ophthalmologist is just as exciting as you can be.
Like, it's interesting, when you Google Eric Donenfeld's name, it's always funny to see like the other searches that come up underneath it. And the other searches for Eric Donenfeld are best ophthalmologist in the U.S., best ophthalmologist in the United States. And then the third one is my favorite, best ophthalmologist in the world. So when you're Googling, those things, Eric's name comes up. Eric, I know you wouldn't describe yourself that way, but just so you know, that's how I think your colleagues view you. And we, we really look up to you in so many ways. And I'm going to share a story. Sometimes as a younger ophthalmologist, you just hold these KOLs in such high regard. You don't know if you should come up and talk to them. Maybe you're a little intimidated, Dr. Donenfeld wouldn't want to talk to me, or he doesn't have time for me, I don't want to bother him. But Eric has always been so gracious with his time, not just for me. I see, walking through the halls, I'll see him stop and talk to anybody, which is really, I think, the mark of someone who really just wants to give back and wants to make the profession better. So quick story, we were doing a KOL, I think, leadership talk for now it's Johnson & Johnson, but then I think it was AMO. And he was talking about patient satisfaction. And this is how you know someone's really been in the game a while, and they're not just a talking head, not just like, you know, consulting, but like really, really deeply involved in patient care. And and the pearl he gave all of us was never let your patient complain. And I thought to myself, well, that doesn't make any sense. You know, the first line on the progress note is chief complaint. I said, what does that mean? He said, you need to make sure that when you walk into the room, you have had your technicians and everybody else fully understand what the patient's complaint is, so that when you walk in, you're not doing any investigating. As a matter of fact, you're walking in and you're telling the patient, Mrs. Jones, I know why you're here. I know why you're upset. As a matter of fact, I think if I were in your shoes, I would be upset as well because of X, Y, and Z. And this is how we're going to get to a resolution. So I hear all that. I think, wow, that's really brilliant. You know, thankfully I don't have any unhappy patients ever. You know, I'll probably never have a chance to use this. Of course, I'm saying that in jest, but it's just so happened the next week I was in clinic and a patient was absolutely irate. And the story goes, she had had a corneal abrasion after cataract surgery, which, you know, to us, this is not a newsworthy event. But for her, she had had so much pain and discomfort. She had tried to call back to the office. She felt like she kind of got blown off, you know, and so she had just really had a bad experience and she was in pain and she felt like no one's really taking care of her. So she comes in just fired up. She brings her son in and they tell me, hey, doc, this patient's really mad. She's 20/20 uncorrected and the abrasion's healed, but she's really mad. And so I'm like, I know what to do. I'm going to do what Eric told me to do. I'm going to tell her exactly why she's upset. And so I did. I told her I did the whole Eric Donenfeld special. Ma'am, I know why you're upset. I would be upset if I were in your situation. I'm very sorry. We've not met our standard. We're going to try and do better in the blah, blah, blah. It disarmed her and turned the whole situation around. As a matter of fact, at the end, she started feeling bad for me because I was so down on myself. She actually kind of gave me a hug and said, well, it wasn't that bad, doctor. It's okay. And her son was sitting there in the corner, not saying a word. I didn't know what he was. I knew he was her son. It turns out he was a malpractice attorney, a medical malpractice attorney. And at the end, he said, you know, if every doctor did what you did just there, he goes, I'd be out of business. And it's like these little pearls that, you know, you listen to the people who are a step or two ahead of you and they'll keep you out of trouble sometimes. And Eric, I know I've told you that before, but I just can't thank you enough for, you know, sharing that wisdom at a really timely moment for me. So there you go.
Well, that's a nice story, but you know, it's just basically the way you approach patients. And what I try to commit to patients and let them know about me is that we're on the same team. You never want to be confrontational with a patient, but once the doctor and the patient get into an argument, the doctor-patient relationship is very difficult to rectify. It's hard to bring it back together. So I always start my conversations with, you know, I know what your problem is, and let's work together that you and I have the same goal is to make you happy. And as long as you realize that I'll do everything for you that you need to do to get you happy, we'll find a solution. But there's nothing that comes out of this by becoming annoyed or angry with each other. And that's really worked for me very well. And it basically states the way I approach my patients. Sometimes you get patients who are a little bit rough. We all have those patients in our practice who are a little difficult to get along with. But at the same time, whether you perceive their problem as insignificant or significant, it doesn't really matter what you think about the problem. It's what the patient thinks about it that really matters.
Eric, can you talk about early on when you were going to start in private practice? What was your first? So I think you worked in academia for a little bit, right? But then you started private practice. When was that? And kind of walk us through, you know, what that was like. Did you hang a sign? Did you buy someone out? What did you do?
Well, I finished my fellowship and I came back to New York and I joined a private practice with my senior partner, Hank Perry, who's about a dozen years ahead of me. And Hank was really my mentor and he really set the tone for me going forward. In the beginning, when I wasn't that busy, I said, you know, I'd love to be involved in academics as well. So I took on the role of resident instructor at Manhattan Eye and Ear, where I trained. So I spent half the time at Manhattan Eye and Ear and half the time starting my private practice. And after a couple of years, I went to become full-time private practice. But I've always maintained an academic association. I always felt that the time I spent with residents was one of the most invaluable times of my life. There's nothing more educational for me than walking someone else through a problem rather than doing it yourself. And when you take someone else through a difficult case, you really learn about how to manage these problems yourself.
And was that practice, was that the same practice that you're in today, OCLI?
Same practice. Well, it wasn't called OCLI then, but yeah, it's the same doctors, and my two senior partners have, you know, basically retired, but the practice is extremely strong, and we, you know, we have some extraordinary doctors. I look at the doctors in my practice, and they're some of the best in the world. You know, I'll just give a shout out: Margaret McDonald, Dick McCool, Rob Noerker. I mean, these are household names in ophthalmology. So we're really fortunate to have some amazing people in our practice.
And what was that practice like when you started way back when? And how many locations? What was the mix? And kind of where did it go before the private equity partnership?
Hey, Blake, we started out, there were three of us. We probably had like 1,500 square feet. We had four exam lanes total, four of us all. We were in one location. And it was a very small practice. And, you know, everything was done manually. We did our own refractions. But the practice has changed, you know, a great deal since then. And I kind of started out more as a pure cornea person than anything else. That was what my fellowship was in. And I feel like I have reinvented myself several times during my career. And if I could give one more word of advice, and that is that you can't be stagnant in ophthalmology. It's a dynamic, changing field, and you have to adjust and you have to make changes. I tell the story all the time about my grandfather, who was my legendary figure growing up. Everybody has that person in your life. You know, Blake is probably your dad, who was to me a legendary figure as well. But my grandfather was that guy for me. And he started a coal business, and it was one of the most successful coal businesses in the entire world. And he taught me two basic concepts. The first concept was the good concept, was that I asked him how he became successful, and he said, give people more than they expect. So he would walk into an apartment building in New York and say, I'm going to sell you 5 tons of coal. And if this coal doesn't burn longer than any coal you ever had, I'll give you your money back. And he would sell them Donenfeld coal, and the coal would burn longer than any other coal that people had bought. And they became very good clients of his. And I said, well, what was the secret to Donenfeld coal? He says, well, I gave him 6 tons. and it burned longer, and they became his clients. But the flip side to that was when my grandfather passed away, the company had gone bankrupt, and I asked him, you know, what happened. And I was just a kid; I was maybe 8-9 years old at the time. And he told me the story. He said one of the lessons that I learned was, if you don't change with the times, you end up going bankrupt. And what he did was, he had the largest coal business in New York, but he never changed to oil. And that's a take-home message I have for a lot of ophthalmologists, is that if you're not changing with the times, you're basically selling coal. And you have to adapt new technology. You have to adopt all these new things that are taking place in ophthalmology. And if you're not doing that, you're going to be behind the time. So a lot of ophthalmologists do everything the way they did in their residency. And I think that there's nothing I do like I did in my residency today. Everything has changed completely.
I was actually in cataract surgery. Those are great stories. I was in cataract surgery the other day and actually thought to myself, you know, I'm 15 years out of residency at this point, and there's not a single step of the procedure that I do now that is exactly how I did it when I was trained. Even how to dissecting, the main incision, everything I do a little bit differently. And so that's great advice. I'd love to know, as we're sort of talking about building your business and brand, you said you've reinvented yourself at multiple points. I'm assuming that there are certain hinge points in your career where either you thought about reinventing yourself one way or the other, changing your practice, either going to another practice or staying, maybe transitioning into phaco, into LASIK, into femto cataract. Can you just kind of touch on some of those hinge points where you made sort of, the decision to reinvent yourself, and how challenging was it? I can only imagine going from extra cap to phaco. That must have been a major transition. But can you just talk a little bit about those transition points? Because I've when I speak to younger ophthalmologists who are saying, you know, I'm thinking about changing my practice situation, whatnot, say, you know, that's fine, you can do that. But the fewer times you change your actual, your position in life, the fewer times you start from zero, the better. So it also seems like you've been able to make it work in your practice. So can you just talk about how you've sort of reinvented yourself at OCLI through the years?
Well, you know, I started out as a fairly, you know, straightforward corneal specialist. I did corneal transplants. I did a little cataract surgery, and that's what I was involved with. And then I got approached by the chairman at ophthalmology at Manhattan Eye and Ear, Jack Doddick, who's become one of my mentors, still is today. And he said, Eric, we have a project that we have in front of us that we'd like you to be involved with. And I asked him about the project, and he said, well, this is the project. He goes, I want you to come into Manhattan Eye and Ear one day a week for 3 years, donate your time. We can't pay you for this. I want you to do a project that probably won't work, but it'll be a good experience for you. And I was about 30 years old at the time. I would just
say, Where do I sign?
And I said, you want me to come and spend a day a week, not get paid, and do something that's probably not going to be effective? He said, yeah. I said, well, that sounds great. I'll take it. And I took the job on as being one of the directors of a new project at Manhattan Eye and Ear called the Excimer Laser. And I was an initial investigator of that excimer laser. And that turned out to be one of the really pivotal moments of my career, and that I shifted from becoming more of a pure corneal specialist to become a corneal refractive surgeon. And that got me pointed in the right direction to do refractive surgery. And being, you know, involved with this since 1989, I was doing this 6 years before it was approved by the FDA. And, you know, had the ability to be one of the first doctors in the world to do this type of surgery. It really gave me a heads up on the importance of research, giving time. And the only thing that Jack lied about was it wasn't 3 years, it was 6 years it took for that to be approved. But it turned out to be one of the best things I did. And then once I got involved with refractive surgery, the next pivot was really to understand that refractive surgery was moving away from cornea or was expanding beyond cornea to cataract surgery as well. And I kind of always viewed cataract surgery as being kind of a simple procedure. I thought cornea was so much more interesting. But about 15 years ago, maybe, I said to myself, the future is going to be lens-based surgery. And that's when I shifted gears again and incorporated that. So I started out with infectious disease and cornea. I expanded to refractive. And then I became more involved in cataract as well. And every one of these steps was incremental. And I don't think I've given anything up. I've just basically expanded my repertoire every couple of years to incorporate all of these things. And if you guys know better than anybody, if you're a refractive surgeon today, you have to do corneal and you have to do lens-based surgery. They just go hand in hand.
Eric, whenever you were growing the practice, I mean, no one succeeded in the business of ophthalmology more than you. What about business outside of ophthalmology? One of the cool things this season, we've talked to, you know, your colleagues of yours who have run successful, you know, real estate syndication projects or have opened restaurants, or, you know, we've talked about some good investments and bad investments. You know, my dad always talks about these cattle and racehorses he used to have, and none of them made any money. Was there any sort of failures that you could share or successes that you could share that had nothing to do with ophthalmology as we start to think about how we can diversify our portfolio outside of eyeballs?
Well, you know, I think that probably the most important investment you have is your family. And it sounds fairly mundane and it sounds fairly simplistic. But if I put any extra time into my career, I say that the best time I spent was investing in my family, making sure that my wife, my two children were always the center of my attention. And that was probably the most proud investment that I had, was my time that I spent doing those things. But as far as financial investments are concerned, you know, I made some bad investments in my career, and my wife likes to point them out very routinely. I've also made some good ones. But, you know, I find that when I invest in things that I don't know about is when disaster usually strikes. So when someone comes up to me and goes, I have an amazing real estate deal for you to get involved in, and I don't know anything about real estate, that turned out to be a bad investment. Another investment that I did, which was actually a fun investment, was I owned one of the hottest restaurants. I didn't own, I had a share of one of the hottest restaurants in New York called Kitty Chai. Madonna used to have her Christmas parties there. Everyone there was beautiful. They wouldn't even let me in the restaurant. I wasn't beautiful enough to walk into the restaurant. And I did it with a lawyer and a very successful businessman. And I kind of just took it for granted that they would make certain that the contracts were done right and everything was done well. And as it turns out, it was all done terribly. And I learned something very, very importantly about investing in other areas right from the beginning, is that when you invest, never allow the managing partner to take a share of the gross. Always make certain that he gets a share of the net, so that if there's any profit to be had, it gets shared evenly. When you take a share of the gross, all the net profit basically goes away. And I kind of trusted that my partners, who were business people and lawyers, would do that. And they clearly didn't. So we had a good time with the restaurant. It did moderately well, but financially, I maybe at best I might have broken even.
Eric, I've heard a rumor. You were talking about your family, and I heard a rumor that your son might have written an essay about Homer Simpson.
Yeah, I'm not sure where you heard that, but that's actually right. That was his application to college. My son ended up going to Harvard, and his application was write an essay about someone, past or present, historical or fictional, and the profound impact that it had on you. And he wrote about Homer Simpson, and it was an extraordinary essay. It actually, was actually listed by Harvard as one of the premier essays of the year. And basically what he said was that as dysfunctional as Homer Simpson is in every single possible way, you don't have to be a perfect person. You can be dysfunctional, but as long as there's love and relationships between people, it all tends to work out at the end. And that was kind of his overview of the story. But yeah, that was his essay. But there are a lot of stories about him. He's a lot more legendary than I am. I can't even get into the stories. I'll tell you the stories about the time the police came over to the house and were eating pizza in my living room at 3 o'clock in the morning because my son invited them over. But that's a story for another day.
Maybe at Academy we can hear more of those stories. That'd be fantastic. Yeah,
that's amazing. Well, I'll tell you what, it's been a wonderful show. It goes by really quick. I thought I was gonna be asking about the Philippines and being born in the Philippines on a Navy base. Gary, I don't know if you know that's the truth, but we didn't have time for that. Is there anything else that we left out, Gary, that we should be asking him about?
I would love to know, I always like to kind of get the perspective of people who've had, like I've said, different chapters. What is the next chapter that you see? I think that people who have been in this space for a while, they are probably the best at forecasting what is coming. Just like 15 years ago, you saw that lens-based surgery was going to be the new refractive surgery or expand to it. Where do you see the puck going, from here? Where do you see things expanding to? What do you think is going to be ophthalmology's or cataract refractive surgery's next chapter? I'm just curious if you've thought about this or, have any opinions.
Yeah, that's really a great question. I think it's a question we should all be asking ourselves. But I think there are a couple of headwinds and tailwinds that are basically dictating where we're going to be going. And one of them is there just aren't enough ophthalmologists. And number two is that the population is aging and there's much more demand than there's ever been. So that I see very clearly in the future that ophthalmology is going to have to partner more with optometry. We're going to have to make certain that we only do the things that we can do best. If it's something that we can't do best, we have to have physician extenders who are going to be involved. I think PAs will play a more major role in ophthalmology going forward as well. And that lens-based surgery will continue to expand and basically eat away a little bit of refractive surgery as people move to younger and younger ages to have lens-based surgery. I think that there will be accommodating lenses that will come very shortly. I'm very excited about drug delivery as being a future for all of us, and we'll be actually not using drops nearly as much as we're using right now. But most of all, few years, I kind of look at where we are now, and I think this is the golden age of ophthalmology. And one of the things I can be absolutely certain about is that the golden age of ophthalmology is today, And the future is even brighter for tomorrow, that there's a lot more things to look forward to. And if I was a young ophthalmologist like the two of you, I would be extraordinarily excited about the future. And if I could do anything in my career right now, is I'd start over again and do it one more time, because there's just a lot of good things to look forward to.
I think there's no better way to wrap it up than that, Blake. What do you say?
Totally agree. You're the man. I remember my first Eric Donenfeld story. He was given it was like a random like Tuesday after Ascaris or AA or something. And there was like a breakfast, but one of the drug or device companies were having, and I was like, I'm not going to this, but it was like, but Eric Donenfeld's going to be there. He's going to speak to us. It's for young ophthalmologists. So I went, and you know, I was a little hungover at the time. Eric wasn't, I was, but I went, and we had a great breakfast, and I was the first one there and the last one to leave. And he and I actually shared a cab back to the main conference area. That's where I first got to meet him. And ever since, you know, he's been kind enough to include me in things and you know, say hello to me. And I know that he's done that for so many other people too. So, but we appreciate that you take time to hang out with us and talk to us.
Well, I just want to finish up by saying, Blake and Gary, you both are just rock stars. You communicate so effectively, and that's really the key to what we do is communication. And I wish I had the abilities that you have today to communicate to people and to really change the future of ophthalmology. What you're doing today is so important. And if I was a young ophthalmologist, I'd be listening to every one of your podcasts to take home the pearls that you're providing every day. So keep up the good work.
Thank you so much, Eric. It means the world to us. This has been Ophthalmology Off the Grid. Until next time.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Ophthalmology Off the Grid. And thank you to our guest, Dr. Eric Donenfeld, for sharing his experiences with us. Until next time.